Welcome to Her Story Podcast.
Son histoire à elle, un balado bilingue qui met en valeur non seulement le succès des femmes du Québec, mais qui souligne leur pratique et vie de tous les jours. I'll be talking with creative, successful and game-changing women who are inspiring and relatable in the ordinary and extraordinary lives they lead.
Hey, this is Kathleen Stavert, your host. When I sat down with Dawn Mauricio, I thought, wow, I could just hang out with this woman forever. She's the type of woman with boundless energy, but knows exactly where to direct it and how to harness it. From a basketball-playing, bigger brother-pleasing girl to a woman who has built a business teaching yoga and meditation pretty much all over the world, sitting down with Dawn was like spending time with a wise, compassionate, and cool best friend. She tells us how she got to where she is now, studying at the historic Spirit Rock Meditation School, and in the spirit of the podcast, delves into what it means to bring the feminine into meditation practice. You'll love her true blue honesty about her own spiritual practice, and the way that she explains it might even encourage you to practice yourself. We can all agree that Dawn brings a fresh perspective to meditation, anchored in inclusivity, diversity, patience, and compassion. You're going to love this one. Oh, and while you're here, why don't you rate, star, review the podcast, share it with a friend, with your sister, with your mother, with your dad, with your dog. I'd really appreciate it. Merci. Hi, Dawn. Hey, girl, what's up?
Hi.
Hey, girl.
Thank you so much for being on my podcast.
Yeah.
So Dawn Mauricio is back from a big world rock star tour.
Oh my god.
But seriously, you've been south of France, South Africa, California,
Toronto, Virginia.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. All for meditation?
South of France wasn't. It's like partly partner's family, partly like partner's friends' weddings and things. Okay. But then what's so funny is that I heard that there's this teacher that is affiliated with the organizations that I am affiliated with who just opened something in the south of France. And so I was like, oh, should I try to teach there or kind of keep south of France just for vacation?
Yeah. So yeah, because when you came in, you said that you'd been away for 151 days this year.
Hope the government isn't listening, but yes.
They probably aren't.
You're so funny.
That's insane.
It's definitely more than I want right now, but our schedules ironically get made 18 to 24 months in advance. So I knew this was too much last September. And then in my mind, it was like, just get to January 2020, and then it's okay.
I think the rest of the world is saying that too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's more than I'd like, but then sometimes when I find myself kind of overwhelmed or like really tired and crying and I call a friend or something, it's really funny because they'll say something like, so you're getting so many invites to teach that you're feeling overwhelmed and you're also so in love with your life at home that you want to be home more. Is that right? And then all of a sudden I feel like I can't really complain. And I'm like, yeah, I love what I do and I love where I live. Yeah. So,
but you're allowed to be tired. You're not a robot.
Totally. Yeah.
But had someone told you 5-7 years ago that you would be traveling around the world teaching and studying meditation, would you have been like, yeah, all right?
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't. It was so not on my radar. It was just something that was like, wouldn't it be nice if I could become a full-time meditation teacher? And then it was like the ultimate dream was like, wouldn't it be nice if I got trained at Spirit Rock? And so it's like the fact that these things are happening feels totally surreal. Wow. And then even though my training ends next year, September 2020, I didn't expect either to have so many invites to teach so early. I honestly thought it would all happen after my training ended. Yeah. And it happened almost instantly for some reason. And so I'm happy that it's all happening. And also that I'm learning lessons around my energy and time and all of this so early on as well. So
then when you do start teaching outside of the training, you know, you learn to manage that. I think
that's like
the ultimate lesson sometimes, I feel, as we get older.
As we get older.
Yeah.
And I also feel in some ways like I'm protected by this training where I feel like I could take time in experimenting, like, what are some avenues of passive income? How would creating digital content or leveraging online, like Zoom or whatever, to teach at a distance, etc. So I'm exploring all of that as a way to, in the future, anticipate traveling less, being home more, etc.
Fait qu'il y a un petit retour en arrière. Comment ça a commencé? Tout a commencé en étant une joueuse de basket,
professeure
de yoga, de tune-up, jusqu'à la méditation. Puis là, la méditation prend tout ton temps. Pourquoi? Comment? Comment t'as fait?
Oui, mais la chose, c'est que j'avais deux frères plus vieux, alors je voulais juste les suivre en faisant ce qu'ils faisaient. Alors, mes deux frères jouaient le basket, alors moi, je me suis engagée à jouer à ça, et puis j'ai joué, je pense que pour 12 ans ou quelque chose, à des niveaux de triple A pour Dawson, etc.
Okay. Ah, t'es allée à Dawson?
Oui.
Wow, je pense que c'était peut-être la troisième ou quatrième invitée qui est allée à Dawson.
Nice! Ouais, c'est vrai. Et puis, je le savais pas à cette époque-là, mais je crois que le basket était ma première introduction à vraiment être ancrée dans mon corps. Et puis après, quand j'ai continué mes études, j'ai arrêté à jouer si fréquemment et tout ça, ça me manquait. Alors c'est pour ça que j'ai commencé le yoga, parce que je trouve qu'il y avait un peu ça aussi, comme l'ancrage dans le corps, etc., puis l'aspect physique aussi. Et puis, mais après quelques années de pratiquer et même d'enseigner le yoga, ça me tentait pour que ça soit plus subtil. Et puis, j'étais pas très sûre dans quelle façon ça va apparaître, cette subtilité-là. Alors, c'est pour ça que j'ai fait la formation de Yoga Tune-Up, parce que je pensais, si j'apprends un peu plus d'anatomie, etc., est-ce que ça va me satisfaire? Et pour certains temps, oui, mais vu qu'il n'y avait pas l'aspect vraiment spirituel, ou au moins ce n'était pas évident pour moi, ça restait quand même physique, anatomique, etc., c'est de là que j'ai commencé à me plonger un peu plus profondément dans mes études bouddhistes.
Okay.
Et puis, juste comme au hasard, les profs aux États-Unis me connaissaient juste parce que je prenais plein de cours, etc. Et puis, quand il y avait la formation de Spirit Rock dont je parlais, ils m'ont invité d'appliquer, parce que c'est vraiment juste par invitation. Ce n'est pas comme une formation de yoga que vous payez et puis vous êtes accepté. C'est comme, il faut être nominé pour cette formation-là, il faut être après invité à appliquer, et puis c'est intense comme application, etc. Alors,
puis c'est un gros, vous n'êtes pas beaucoup dans le programme.
Non, on est 20.
C'est ça, puis ça dure, c'est 4 ans?
4 ans.
Oui, 4 ans, oui. Ouais, c'est quelque chose, there's a lot of commitment.
Yeah, et puis en plus, la chose que ça m'étonne, c'est que Spirit Rock ne nous demande pas pour des frais de tuition.
Ah, OK.
Alors, ils nous payent les billets d'avion. Quand on est là, on est hébergé, they provide food as well, et puis il n'y a pas de frais pour la formation non plus. Et puis quand les personnes les demandent pourquoi ils font cette formation-là, ça fait 40 ans qu'ils l'offrent dans cette façon-là. Et puis pour Spirit Rock, c'est juste pour que ces enseignements-là continuent. Alors, c'est tellement inspirant et un peu comme anti-capitalist.
I was just gonna say.
Yeah.
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 Wow, we need more of that shit.
Exactly. Puis j'adore. It's like, when people hear what I do, they think it's weird. Then they hear that I don't actually have a salary. All of my salary, I'm using air quotes, is donation. And so, like, I'll go for a week and I don't know if I'll make zero, 500, 5,000. You know, like, I have no idea.
It's all the participants that go to the Spirit Rock Meditation Center or whatever and pay by donation.
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible.
And it's funny because at some time, like, with another organization, they said, do you want the salaried position to help with, like, programming or something like that? And I noticed that I had this contraction or aversion to it, where I've been so used to not getting paid now, where it's like suddenly having a list of tasks and a price tag attached to it felt like very limiting, or almost like gave me more room, I imagine, to be like resentful if someone asked me to do something outside of that list.
Absolutely. And you know, there's a sense of keeping your own agency as well. Yeah. I think it's a very much a freelance model.
Yeah.
Where you have your own agency. You may not get paid. You may not get paid on time. You never know how much you're going to make in a year. But at least you have that, your own freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a good way to put it.
And the only person you can be resentful around is yourself and your choices.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about what your meditation practice looked like prior to a lot of your training, maybe even backtracking before Spirit Rock.
Yeah. It's so funny because it is wildly different. So at the beginning, when I first started, I learned on this monastery in Thailand when I was backpacking.
Beautiful.
And during like a quarter life crisis. And so when I came home, I was so intense about practice where I was practicing like 2 hours a day. Yeah, it was like I was so rigid about my practice.
It was a Buddhist practice? Yes.
Yeah. So same tradition that I'm still in, but I didn't realize that there are so many ways that it can be expressed and practiced. Mm-hmm. And so back then it was like, because I learned from like monks or on a monastery, it was pretty rigid. And I thought, well, this is the only way to do it. And so I brought home that rigidity. And then I also noticed, in hindsight, I noticed that I wasn't good at integrating it into daily life.
Yeah.
So I was like really protective of my practice. And then my boyfriend at that time and my mom had this like mini intervention with me. I don't think it was planned because it was at separate times, but pretty close together, where they were like, you know, you go on these retreats and you practice so many hours a day, but you get so angry like really quickly and you're impatient and all of this stuff. And then I took it like an accusation and I was defensive. and then after I realized that they were right, and it was more like how I was practicing, I wasn't really tuned into, where my instructions were focus on the breath, and when my mind wanders, to bring it back to the breath. But when I was bringing it back, I was so like judgmental to myself, mm-hmm. and like, you should stay on the breath, and why is your mind wandering, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so because I was holding myself to these impossible standards, then I didn't realize that I was imposing that on other people, because that's kind of like what I was practicing.
Yeah.
So over the years, after seeing that more and really making an effort to integrate it into life, it's so much more vibrant and alive and organic. And so I really see that there's no separation between life and practice. And I teach a lot in teams. And so I notice, what I love is when I bump up against, say, a particular view, like if I'm holding on to a particular opinion, I realize that that's an opportunity for me to kind of like settle back and try and get a larger perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one way that I see it come alive in my daily life. Mm-hmm. And then in my formal practice, it's kind of more like tuning in when it's practice time and being like, what do I need? What would serve my mindfulness, my body, and my heart right now? And depending on like my energy, I could maybe do walking meditation. Or if I'm feeling particularly anxious, it would be running meditation even.
Mm.
If I'm feeling pretty calm, then it'll be sitting meditation and maybe like open awareness practice. If I'm feeling like sad or emotional, it might be compassion or loving kindness.
Mm.
So it's more like I let my life dictate what my practice will be, as opposed to my practice dictating or imposing itself onto my life.
Yeah. C'est vraiment inspirant, parce que je pense que les gens sont intimidés par la méditation, justement parce qu'on a souvent une vision très rigide de qu'est-ce qu'est la méditation. Souvent, les gens me disent au yoga, je suis pas capable de méditer, j'arrête pas de penser.
Yeah.
And I guess you really have to just start practicing to realize that it's not about not thinking, right? And to being so attuned to exactly that, to exactly your needs,
mm-hmm.
and that it can have fluidity.
Yeah.
It can be, that's really inspiring to hear, meditation teacher.
Yeah.
And so I guess like, do you have a set amount of time that you give yourself, or does it completely depend?
Yeah, so that's another thing that I trust myself enough to be fluid with how long I practice, mostly because I've had years already of setting up this like foundation of practice.
Yeah.
So, for example, it's like if I have 20 minutes, I'll practice. But if suddenly I thought I had 20 and I only have 5, I find, at least in the past, my habit was to be like, oh, well, then I'm not going to practice because it's not my in- what I had intended, but 5 minutes is better than no minutes.
Yeah.
And so that's why I tell students that I see or meet, I say, set the bar low. If you know you can fully commit to 5 minutes a day, do that. Mm-hmm. And then check in at the 5 minute mark. Can I do more? And if you can, then do more, as opposed to saying you're going to practice 20 minutes and then feeling like a failure every day if you don't get there. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that, when you were talking about various work at Spirit Rock, you mentioned that you would feel a sort of contraction in your body. And I think that's such a wonderful and interesting thing. And I'm personally becoming more and more attuned to those contractions.
Yeah.
Because I think that we're so encouraged to just push forward. Yeah. and do the thing that you need to do. Puis on est tellement encouragé aussi à produire, faire de l'argent.
Yeah.
Puis c'est vraiment intéressant que les portes qui s'ouvrent quand on ressent la réaction.
Yeah.
Quasiment chimique dans le corps.
Vraiment.
Quand on rencontre quelque chose. Est-ce que ça pourrait faire partie d'une certaine méditation? Can you talk a little
oui.
bit more about that?
Je dirais que ça vient vraiment d'une pratique de la pleine conscience du corps.
Okay.
Et puis souvent, mais la raison pour laquelle moi je suis très intéressée par la contraction et l'expansion dans le corps, c'est comme cette sentie-là, the felt sense of it, c'est parce que quand j'étais jeune, je n'étais pas encouragée de vraiment être connectée avec mes émotions, mes sentiments. Alors, en tant qu'adulte, c'était difficile pour moi de juste me plonger dans cette realm of emotions.
Right.
Et puis, j'ai vraiment commencé avec, est-ce que je me sens la contraction ou l'expansion? Et puis, de là, les portes
sont ouvertes.
vers ça, mais avant, j'ai passé comme des années à juste explorer ça.
Ouais.
Et je trouve qu'il y a une sagesse dans le corps qui précède vraiment le mental, l'esprit. Alors, c'est pour ça que j'essaie de ramener de plus en plus mon attention à mon corps, juste comme n'importe quand. Comme ça serait une connexion un peu plus forte. Et puis, quand je suis en dialogue ou en relation avec quelqu'un, vu que la relation avec mon corps ou la connexion est déjà établie, ça serait, en guillemets, plus facile pour moi de sentir quand il y a la contraction en plein milieu d'une conversation, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Parce que des fois, ça passe très vite, ça roule vite, des décisions ou quoi. Mm-hmm. Alors, ça prend une pratique. Et puis, aussitôt qu'on décide que « Ah, j'aimerais explorer ça », je trouve que c'est, au moins pour moi, c'est important de ne pas, d'avoir des attentes que ça va se passer comme ça tout de suite.
Ouais.
C'est vraiment, ça m'a pris des années, et puis, I still get disconnected, of course, but,
yeah. There's so much conditioning to undo.
Yeah,
oh
vraiment.
My God. Yeah.
Et puis, je trouve que when we have, like, small moments, comme dans le métro, or at a red light, or whatever, si on pourrait pratiquer de revenir au corps,
oui.
et de garder ça simple, what do I feel inside, expansion, contraction, ou ça peut être comme la confusion, parce que ça prend une habitude aussi de sentir ça. Je trouve que when you do that, like, say, a minute or 30 seconds, all day long, here and there, ça fait comme 5-10 minutes à la fin de la journée. So I feel like if that's a doorway into practice for some people, that's totally valid.
Yeah. I heard you talk about bringing the feminine to meditation.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that? Obviously, this is a feminist podcast, so this question was coming, and I adore this.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What does that look like?
Yeah, so... Just, I mean, oh my God, where to start?
Yeah.
So I feel like...
Getting excited
The Buddha, when he was passing away, his followers would say, like, who's next in line? Like, who's going to take over kind of thing? And the Buddha was like, no, like, do not take my word for it. I'm not the guy. Like, actually challenge my teaching. See for yourself what's true. Be a lamp unto yourself. And so... I really love that as an invitation to be discerning about the practice and what is being taught to us. And so often, at first, I didn't question much because I was just kind of absorbing it all. And then after a few years, I started questioning things that didn't feel right to me and kind of going back into thinking, well, you know, the teachings weren't written down for 200 years after he passed away. Who was in the room when these teachings were written down? And it was like high-ranking monks, basically.
Yeah.
So men.
Men.
And then what happens is it's a very patriarchal system, even though we might think that it's like a very loving and accepting, it is, and there's definitely traces of all of that. So much so that today nuns in certain countries are don't get the same ordination level as monks, because I mean, it's kind of frustrating where they'll say things like, oh, but you're too distracted, like you can't achieve the same level of enlightenment as us, so we're not going to bother giving you full ordination. Anyways.
You're too distracted?
Yeah.
Because you have a uterus?
Or yeah. Like, or they'll say things like, oh, because of technology. And it's like, but they have the same tools. Like, anyway, so it's a whole thing. And of course, that's an oversimplification of that. But
right. Yeah.
Anyways, and so I find also in the Western world, like, who are the dominant voices? And it has been mostly men. And on top of it, it's also like a lot of, say, like East Coast, highly educated European American teachers. Mm-hmm. And so it's like that, as a result, also has this very intellectual feel, this kind of like you need to figure it out on your own as opposed to in community kind of feel too.
And a high and a sort of like privileged hierarchy.
Totally. Yeah. And then what I often also ask is when they went to go practice and their teachers gave them like their authorization to teach, what did they leave out? And so I find things like the rituals are often left out, the chanting, full body bowing, which is like I love as like a way to release energy as someone who has a lot of energy. The mystical, I find. So it's like I on certain retreats when I thought I was gonna give up because it was just so intense, I would feel like a presence of a guide. And I could never really talk about that with my teachers because I felt like that wasn't something that was kind of part of our tradition, the Western Dharma kind of tradition. But it's very much part of my practice. And so it's like figuring out where that fits in. I also find in our tradition, we prioritize formal practice where it's like sit as much as you can or do as many long retreats, like 4 to 12 week retreats, or if possible, become a monk or a nun sometime in your life. And so it's just like, well, what about the people who don't have access to funds or time away or for whom, because of trauma, this isn't possible?
Yeah.
And so for me, feminine really also is like, can we, again, like this idea of broadening our perspective so that more different types of experiences and more bodies can be in the room.
Yeah. And just bringing a little bit of a, when I heard you talk about the feminine in meditation, it just softened everything for me. Qu'il y avait pas cette rigidité là dont tu parlais au début.
Yeah.
Puis qu'il y avait une genre de d'ouverture, like a divine opening to like and just connection.
C'est ça. Exactement.
You know? Yeah.
Et puis je trouve que quand on apprend comment méditer, c'est plus une partie de mindfulness qui emphasize, qui est la partie un peu plus activée. Et ça veut dire que de diriger l'attention encore et encore à une certaine ancre, or an anchor. Mais il y a l'autre côté, je trouve, qui n'est pas souvent parlé, or it is, mais more as a way to serve the active, which is the receptive quality. Like, can we just kind of settle back and watch how life is showing up for us instead of us needing to do something about it. So this one of the practices that I practice is open awareness, where it's more like you're sitting back and you're not controlling. Like if the mind is agitated and jumping from one thing to another, it's more like, can you practice being kind to the mind that's really agitated right now, as opposed to being like, let me bring it back to the breath or whatever over and over. So that's like a more, say, direct way that we can practice this feminine quality of receptivity.
Yeah, that's so great.
It's so simple, and yet it's so hard because our conditioning, like we live in this patriarchal society, and I feel like a lot of us women have been conditioned into conforming to, okay, what will get us ahead? And as a result, it's like these very patriarchal qualities, like I don't even want to say masculine, because maybe like toxic masculine qualities. So yeah.
Well, it's a lot of women that are sort of forced to take on exactly like patriarchal productivity and result.
Yeah, exactly. Like Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and like the whole like leaning in. What if we just leaned back
exactly
and like didn't strive for better and better and better and being
exactly
the best?
Exactly. Yeah.
You've been teaching a lot of sessions or sits. Can I call them sits?
Yeah. So I'm trying to move away from the word sit
because it doesn't have to be sitting.
Exactly. And it's not so inclusive if someone is unable to sit, whether it's because of illness or whatever. So, yeah.
I like that. Yeah. Okay. For people of color.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about, can you just talk to the importance of this and how meditation can be a modality of healing for people of color?
Yeah. So the reason why we have this like affinity group is because I feel like the experience of people of color is quite different than that of say people of color as part of the dominant or mainstream culture, mm-hmm. or very different from the white experience kind of thing, mm-hmm. where like, for example, for me, I've had to assimilate all my life kind of thing, where if people look at me closely, I cut my food with my left hand because I only learned how to use like a knife and fork just from watching people, because was born with a fork and spoon. Like that's what we did in my household.
That's so interesting.
So little things like of assimilation, and there's like a ton of examples of that.
Yeah.
And so what I didn't realize until I started attending myself years ago, like these sanghas or these communities that were just for people of color, I didn't realize that in the dominant spaces, because in at least in California and actually in most meditation communities that I know of, it's like this luxury. So it's a lot of white people, a lot of retired people, mm-hmm. kind of thing. And mm-hmm. and so what happened was that there was like a certain holding that I did, but because I was so used to it, I wasn't realizing that I was doing that. Only when I went into a POC or a person of color space that I felt this like deep visceral relaxation that I hadn't expected at all. And then at first I was just more like an observer, because I was like, am I a person of color? Which is something that I've heard a lot of Asians actually struggle with, because our experience is not as acute, say, as the Black experience, especially in the US. Mm-hmm. And then we're often considered like model minorities. So, you know, anyways.
But there's still, I'm sure there's still a lot of like fetishization and like, just those little details
totally.
That you were talking about.
And
especially in the quote unquote wellness world.
Yes.
I mean, I know the work that you do is so much deeper in that, but on a surface level, yoga, you know, where people are introduced to meditations like yoga studios and retreats,
mm-hmm.
it's just, it is such a white privileged space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Highly,
yeah.
highly
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Kind of makes my skin crawl sometimes.
Yeah.
But yeah.
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 And so, yeah, so then we created these, like when I'm in the city, they're monthly. And then when I'm
in Montreal?
In Montreal. And when I'm on retreats, often we'll have like a separate, say like one practice in a different room for the people who self-identify as a person of color. And so it's just kind of like sharing space with like-bodied people kind mm-hmm. of thing. And so, and what has been helpful for me, especially on large retreats of like 100 or 100 plus people, when I have that space, I can kind of know who the others are in like the bigger room, so that if I'm feeling unsafe or watched or something, then I can kind of like look towards them or sit near them, and just being in their presence gives me a sense of safety.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what is the feedback that you get from those communities and those groups?
So from the people of color groups, it's been so welcome, because there's also people who are just waking up to their race, mm-hmm. Later in life. And so it's like we try to make it really a welcoming space where all levels of exploration are welcome, of course. And then people can start touching into any microaggressions or trauma or whatever that just comes from being minorities mm-hmm. all the time. And ironically, though, from some of the dominant culture, there's pushback of, well, why do you have to separate? And just kind of like...
Of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course there's going to be that, yeah.
So it's a little bit of everything. And it's so delicate, of course.
Yeah.
And But it's been so healing and so fun to hear, like, when we do our monthly practices, it's very different from when we teach, or when I teach the mainstream or dominant culture, where it's more kind of like a monologue, and it's like I show up and I have a teaching prepared. But in the POC settings, it's more like an open discussion, because we want it to be also like anti-patriarchal in terms of, like, we don't want it to have a rigid form. And so one month we were talking about like our names, and so the lead-in was, you know, what is your name, and how do you, can you talk for about 3 or 5 minutes about your name? Because often as people of color, there are parts of our names that we leave out because it's hard for other people to pronounce or something like that.
Yeah. Or it's confusing. If they have a perceived sort of dominant culture name, but they don't look that way.
Exactly.
People are just like, yeah, but...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we just kind of share and talk about stuff like that. So,
And do you find that that sort of facet of meditation has helped to perhaps heal, like, the lineage or intergenerational trauma?
Yeah, I think it's one of the tools that can. I don't believe that meditation is, like, the tool for everything. And so I feel like it can definitely set us on that track. I know it has for me, where... stuff like, you know, if I work with thoughts, which is something that I try to take responsibility, not just for my actions, but also starting to see what thoughts arise and how I might feed them or whatnot. And then when I think of my aging mom, who's like a hoarder now, and I can totally see why, because she grew up in poverty and all of that stuff, to realize that I don't have to take her anxiety or her fear on. And so in some ways I feel like meditation can start healing and start breaking certain cycles. But certain cycles and certain traumas are really deep and intense, that it's going to take more than just being mindful of it. So
You did a 3-month silent retreat. Trois mois en silence. Est-ce que tu peux nous parler un peu de ça?
Oh my gosh.
What did you gain? What did you lose? What happened?
Oh my God.
C'était la
chose la plus difficile que j'ai fait dans ma vie. Vraiment.
Et est-ce que, j'imagine que t'es quand même une parleuse. Tu sais, il y a des gens qui sont capables. Moi, je pourrais ne pas parler peut-être pendant 2 jours. Je me vois comme ça, mais...
Ah, oui.
Pour quelqu'un comme toi qui a beaucoup d'énergie, qui aime parler, tu sais, ça devait...
C'était hyper difficile dans ce sens-là, parce que pour moi, de parler, c'est une façon de connexion pour moi. Et en plus, si on enlève ça, et puis il n'y a pas de touche, il n'y a pas de eye contact, alors c'était... Je trouvais que c'était très froid, en fait.
Il n'y a pas ça non plus.
Non.
Aucun contact avec les autres participants.
Et puis la chose, c'est que vu que tout le monde pratique la pleine conscience, il n'y avait même pas quelqu'un... who bumped into me by accident. C'est même ça, il n'y avait pas ça comme touche. C'est ça. Alors, j'ai trouvé ça très, très difficile. Alors, mais la chose, une chose que j'ai pris de ça, c'est que I need to, in those moments, peut-être pas toujours, mais I need to be my own resource. Alors, j'ai commencé à me masser comme les bras, de me câliner et tout. Et puis, c'était satisfaisant, mais pas comme... autant que si je recevais un câlin d'une amie ou quoi.
I think from an outside point of view, we sometimes expect to go on retreat and receive some kind of outer worldly message or enlightenment or, you know.
No.
So that did not happen.
C'est non, parce que même après 2 mois et demi, avant la retraite, I was like, I'm going to be a totally different person. All of my problems will be solved, etc.
Did you really think that?
Well, I was in a different relationship at that time, and we would often bump heads. And then I felt, whether it was because I was told or otherwise, but I felt like a lot of it was rooted in things that I could change. Like, oh, maybe I can be more impatient, more patient, or more accepting, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a part of me that was like, this retreat will help me with all those things.
It'll solve, I will solve something in me.
Exactly. Which was
so... We tend to take a lot of the blame.
Which was so surprising, because years ago, I remember when I first started meditating, I wanted to be an introvert. And so I thought that that would make me an introvert, but obviously, no.
You had a special goal to be an introvert. That's
because I'm someone with like a lot of energy. And so I often felt like it was too much for people.
You were taking up too much space. Yeah. Right.
And so then I thought being an introvert would solve all my problems.
So I'll just shut up for 3 months.
Yeah, exactly. But of course not. And so I remember looking at the calendar and being like, oh my God, 2.5 months passed and my mind is still like this. It was so humbling and so disappointing at the same time.
Right.
But it was just really like, again, realizing that the mind is not the enemy. And so it's more like, as a result, how can I befriend the mind or these qualities that I was making out to be the enemy? And it's not so much like working against, but it's more like working with, because these things might be part of my life forever. Mm-hmm. And can that be okay?
Yeah.
And it's when I make it not okay, that then there's all that suffering that arises. So.
Did that information come to you in hindsight once you had come back into the world, bright lights, colors and stuff?
Yeah.
Like, was it a few weeks or even months after where you started to integrate?
So I felt like, because 3 months is a long time, the integration of that started on the retreat. And then just over the years, because that was such a, like a deep realization, and more than just intellectual, that it's just gotten solidified over the years of seeing that. But of course I slip, like if I'm distracted or tired or not like resourced, like haven't eaten well because of like airport food or something like that, then it's easier to forget these kinds of things, I find. So yeah.
Obviously, you just told us about your practice, that you do every day, some type of practice.
Yeah.
What would you say in, I mean, this is such a big question, but I'm going to, you can try to answer it or not, but what are the ways in which your life has changed? Like, probably on a very subtle level and yet on a huge level.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Like, I just got chills for some reason when you said that, because I don't hide the fact that formal practice is on retreat is really challenging for me. So I did, since that 3 month retreat, I did a 6 week and 2 month longs. And it was more like in like a 2.5 year period. And it was kind of part of like this experiment for me of like, is this practice, long retreat, intensive practice of like practicing 15 hours a day or 12 hours a day, is this good for this system of that was mine? And so and it was more like to see if, because we glorify in my tradition long retreat practice and all of that, it was like, is it true? Because it doesn't actually feel right in my body. And I think under certain conditions it can be, but I don't think it's necessarily for everybody. And so as a result, I'm really open with that. It's a challenge for me, where it's the only place I've actually had panic or anxiety attacks.
Wow.
Yeah, ironically, because it's like meditation or whatever. And so all that to say is, what keeps me dedicated to the practice is the ways that the qualities that I cultivate on retreat show up in my daily life.
Okay.
And so that's why I think I really try to bring mindfulness into my daily life, so that it continues to feed me and inspire me. So in just like the ways that I find that I'm more able to kind of settle back and try to get a larger perspective, like empathize with different situations that I don't understand, and I don't have to understand every situation, but can there still be room in my heart for that, you know, like political affiliation or whatever? So there's that. And then certainly this deep love for myself and my imperfections, and this non-fear about emotions. So like, I went through the surprise breakup last year and it was so intense, and I realized I had the privilege to have this schedule that's kind of really on or really off. Like, I'll work intensely for 2 or 3 weeks and then be off for 5 weeks or something. And even when I work, it's around people who meditate, so they're exploring the same things.
Yeah, there's an allowance for emotions.
Totally.
And
so I want to like take advantage of that. And so when the loss happened, and I was like, I don't know when the next time I'll be able to be with grief is. So let me give myself completely over to it. And I would cry for 3-4 hours a day for months. Wow. And I was lucky that I had the resources to see a psychotherapist and a somatic experiencing practitioner for any ways trauma was locked in my body. Mm-hmm. And so it's given me a certain fearlessness as well for the natural occurrences of life. But as humans who are busy and distracted, we often don't make room or time for mm-hmm. these natural occurrences like intense emotions.
There's so. Also in kind of in the like self-development world, there's like a, you know, comme un barrage sur les émotions. Yeah. Like you don't want to feed into the negative emotions because you don't want to bring anything more in. But I'm realizing
I'm so against that.
And I'm realizing more and more these days that if I just really sit, like I feel like I'm actually like free falling as opposed to sitting, but just free falling with the physical emotion that whatever circumstance or thought has brought up, that I'm actually like, I'm loving myself in a way. Like it's the biggest form of relief actually that I haven't felt in ever before. It's really, it's interesting. And
what's amazing is like the deeper you go into yourself, then the more you're able to hold others so that in your presence, they'll also become fearless in exploring their emotions or whatever it might be.
Yeah. So it's not a luxury in a way. Like just a few more questions. Quick question. You're running a business? Like do you see it that way? It's, you have a lot of stuff going on online.
It's so interesting because when I was in the yoga world, it definitely felt like I was running the business of Dawn. And for some reason, I don't have that same thinking as I teach meditation. But I think that's a temporary thing. I think it's mostly because right now, I'm busy teaching with other organizations, so I'm not forced as much to do my own marketing or whatever. But in my quest to travel less, I am exploring how to leverage online stuff more, et cetera. And so as a result, that's where like the business kind of thinking comes in again.
Right.
So, yeah.
But was that kind of, maybe even when you were teaching yoga, but was that a... was that an intention to kind of build something that you could manage on your own and that you could offer up? Was it like, I have a structure, I have a plan? Was it?
No, I wish. I really wish. And so I feel like I joke around and I say, I need an assistant just to tell me to get off Instagram every few hours or whatever, you know? I'm like good at creating ideas and then it's like I feel like I don't have time to put them into action.
And to follow through with
and to follow through. Yeah. So that's the challenge. But no, it was mostly like testing something out, but being able to, like pretty early on, say with teaching yoga, once I remember, I think I was teaching 18 classes a week or something like that. And I feel like all teachers, yoga teachers go through that at some point.
I think you have to. Yeah. To realize what you're not going to do.
And that was like maybe my second year of teaching. Mm-hmm. And even though I taught for 13 years, I was like, this is not sustainable. Like, let me start thinking of other ways to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And I think because I went to business school, I have a bachelor's of commerce in marketing. And so I think that was like a natural way of thinking of like, okay, long term. And I'm not one to create like 5-year goals necessarily, but it's more like, okay, long term, if this isn't going to work, what can I see for myself? And then slowly start building in that way. And so like with the traveling, I want to travel less, but not rushing it so that I'm kind of stuck with not a lot of income or something like that. So like setting up things so that when I do start traveling less, I'm not picking things up out of fear. Like, yes, I'll teach that or yes, I'll teach that. But
my God, that's a huge lesson. That's really, that's really great to hear from you because that's a huge lesson that I know a lot of like self-employed entrepreneur business or even just, you know, anybody who's building the life that they want, it's really hard to not pick up things out of sense of lack or fear.
And we, just like patriarchy, we swim in this like ocean of scarcity where it's like, I have, because one of the things I'm involved in, I'm a mentor in this online training. Mm-hmm. And even that gives me more salary than I ever earned as a yoga teacher. Mm-hmm. But I still notice that I want to do things out of fear because there's all this space in my schedule or something like that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So I'm also trying to step out of this feeling of scarcity. But when the world operates under that guise, it's so hard.
Do you feel guilty?
I feel guilty because of the capitalist model as well of, yeah, like, productivity is my worth.
Like, if you're not doing anything on a Wednesday afternoon, yeah, what's wrong with,
yeah,
you?
Yeah. Or like, it doesn't matter that I just taught for like 7 days, 16 hour days. And like travel,
just been on the red,
you know,
eye. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then it's like, and I'll still feel like, but it's a Monday. And even though I just got off the plane, I still need to do something,
yeah,
you know, like, so trying to see that and not buy into it.
Yeah. That's something that I'm working with at,
yeah,
the moment is,
yeah,
that idea of productivity and guilt.
Yeah,
yeah.
And guilt.
Like, but, and I realize, where does it come from? You know,
yeah,
what we're fed,
yeah,
what we're taught.
Exactly.
From the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, yeah, like, I wonder if like, to genderize this, like, if a man had a similar schedule, and then, like, would he be more permissive of rest than women, for example? And I think, yes,
probably.
I think that's, like, part of male privilege,
yeah,
where,
yeah,
certain things, like, I come home, and then I feel like, but the house needs to be in order. You know, when my,
yeah,
partner, and not to, you know, talk down about him, but like, he's more able to let the house be messy for a couple days and then when he has energy. And so I'm trying,
yeah,
to lean into that a little more as,
yeah,
well, that,
yeah,
guilt piece. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting. That's really comforting to hear. I think it's something that I really like to talk about on the podcast is, you know, all the wonderful things in our lives that we've created, but also a lot of the kind of the failures that we feel and how we,
mm-hmm,
but how that opens up different experiences,
yeah,
as well. And talking about our shortcomings, because I don't think that that's really shared enough in,
yeah,
in public spaces,
no,
and in our earbuds. And
no.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you,
yeah,
for sharing that.
Yeah.
Where can people find you?
Where is the $1 million question?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
So right now, if people go onto my website, that at least is up to date.
Okay,
and
that's
so,
DonMauricio.com?
Exactly, okay. Yeah. And right now, I have a few more trips to California this year. But then towards the end of the year, I want to do like a day-long retreat here in the city. And I actually really miss teaching in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
This year, I haven't done a lot of it because, mm-hmm, of my travel. But I really credit the Montreal community for making me the teacher I am,
mm-hmm,
because it's where I taught for so many years.
Yeah, and there's such a richness to it. Like, so many, like, just the bilingualism,
yeah,
and the, you know, the different people and bodies that come in and people,
yeah,
show up.
Yeah, and like the socialism, like the kind of going against the norm, I,
yeah,
like to.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
No, we love our,
yeah,
our Montreal community.
Yeah,
yeah. Last question. Can you complete this phrase, Dawn is a vehicle for?
Oh. Oh my God, this is so good. Okay, wait. Dawn is a vehicle for kindness and self-acceptance.
That's two words.
Oh.
I usually, but
okay,
I love,
okay,
that.
Okay,
I,
well,
love,
wait,
it.
One word is the challenge?
Well, I actually didn't mention one,
okay,
word, but usually,
okay,
it's one word. But kindness,
okay,
and self-acceptance is pretty great, and,
yeah,
I believe it.
Because I just feel like these spiritual practices, yoga or meditation, we can take it so seriously and then just only see and only see like the ways we don't level up. But
oh,
it's,
God,
like,
yeah,
it's so not about that. And then when we have the kindness and self-acceptance, it becomes so fun, I feel. Like seeing yourself face plant when you're trying crow pose or something,
mm-hmm,
or like thinking that you'll be an introvert after a 2-day meditation retreat or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I hear that, Dawn. Thank you so,
yeah,
much for coming and sharing on this thank you for coming and sharing on this,
yeah,
podcast. It sounds cheesy, but it's a real treat to have you.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for your patience. Like, you wrote me and then I
forgot about the message for months.
You know, I know that you're really busy, but you're still making time for this, and I'm sure people will really benefit
from
it.
Thank you.
So just want to make sure. So your website, Dawn Mauricio, and then your schedule is there if people want to follow you on a retreat at some point.
Exactly. And then I also am pretty active on Instagram, active-ish. And that's where I also try to post, like I try to make Instagram a refuge that when people land on my profile or photos, that it's not like the other stuff that's out there, but it's like something that invites either reflection or space or even just like a deep breath or something like that.
It is really diverse. I really enjoy your Instagram page.
And then of course there's like a little bit of crazy in there, like me dancing and pantless and stuff
like
that.
That's fine. Exactly. We need a little bit of crazy.
Exactly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.